One of the things I really love about Zen now, like kind of thinking about it being exposed to the other traditions, is that there's something very simple about it. It's like you are Buddha, you are awakened. You have the wisdom and compassion within you. All you need to do is sit and connect to it.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowicz. This season is all about listening, and so for us, that means listening to voices from outside the Catholic Church, do a little bit of interreligious dialogue here. Right now, we are in our second Buddhism episode. It started in the last episode, so if you didn't get a chance to listen to Kyra Jewel Lingo, I definitely recommend that. I think she's a great beginning to just what we're talking about as we start to explore these Buddhist voices. And this episode with Amy Kisei is just a great development of that. So I don't think I need to say much. You're in for a treat. Let's get started. We're here with Amy Kisei Sensei, who is a Zen Buddhist priest, teacher, and spiritual counselor with 12 years of full-time monastic training from Great Vow Zen Monastery. Kisei currently lives as an urban mystic interested in the ecologies of awakening and the play of spirit and soul. She is the guiding teacher for Mud Lotus Sangha in Columbus, Ohio, and one of the Sesshin leaders and Zen teachers in the Zen community of Oregon. Kisei publishes her Dharma talks and writings on the Substack platform Earth Dreams. Amy, so good to have you. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
So you and John, or as you like to call him, Grib, go way back, I hear.
Yeah.
How long is like 25 years?
Is it that long since I graduated high school?
What, 2005 you graduated, right?
2003.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what is that? That is like almost 25 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 23 or 22 years.
Look at that. Wow, that's what happens. But, you know, it was a great honor to have you speak to my students a couple of years ago here in San Francisco at Sacred Heart Cathedral when I was teaching comparative religions. And I was really happy that we connected that way. And, you know, you were so ahead of the curve, so to speak, in recognizing something that was extremely important for your own spiritual enrichment journey, however you want to look at it, maybe far before I stumbled across it, and that was Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it might be kind of fun for you just to kind of talk about your background, you know, even before we met, and how you went from being, you know, at Allentown Central Catholic High School, and then what you did to really put your heart and soul into this practice, which has kind of, I think, really been transformative for so many people. And I include myself in that because it's just, I've learned so much from you over the years. So how about you just walk us through that?
Yeah. It started in high school, actually. And I call it a kind of spiritual crisis, a kind of questioning that arose when I was in my junior or senior year, which for me was around the time of 9/11. And I can't tell you exactly why that brought up the kind of like angst and questioning that it did. But for whatever reason, just the way I was raised and my own nervous system at the time, like I've kind of fell into a spiritual crisis. And somebody gave me a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't even remember who. It might have been my high school boyfriend. It might have been somebody else. I can't remember. But the book was really, really pivotal for me. And it felt like, and similar to what you just said, it felt like yes, this resonates. This is speaking to something that I haven't been able to articulate yet. And that's what set me interested in meditation and kind of devouring Buddhist books. Most of them by Thich Nhat Hanh was really accessible at that time. And he also had this flavor of social engagement, social activism that felt important to me, especially in high school and surrounding the Iraq War. And
And that was Living Buddha, Living Christ, right? Was that the
the first book I got from him was Peace, I think it's called Peace in Every Step.
Peace in Every Step? Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
and then I read Living Buddha, Living Christ. And then
Did
I
I?
read his more like technical Buddhist books, and I was like, oh, I need to learn to meditate. And,
Pieces Every Step has been sitting by my bedside. I read a little bit of it every once in a while. It's been there for over a year, though it's really small. But it's perfect for that, right? It's like you just get a little bit and just kind of try to breathe it in, I guess, before I sleep.
Yeah, I feel like Thich Nhat Hanh's books and a number of the more contemporary Buddhist teachers who publish their books are like that. They're like meant, I feel like meant to be read more as contemplative prayer or meditations than
Yeah.
like something that you devour and like, okay, got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like any spiritual practice is never something that you can be done with, right? That's the whole point of having a practice. So that's right. So I guess that kind of helps explain how you find yourself in the Zen style of Buddhism. Is that right? Kind of influenced by
Yeah,
the
influenced by
experience.
Thich Nhat Hanh. And then, for whatever reason, anybody I met who was Buddhist who was actually practicing, which that happened once I went to college, they had a Zen background. And so I ended up like being introduced to Zen teachers and sitting with Zen sanghas. And I kind of didn't really even know there were other options. And one of the things I really love about Zen now, like kind of thinking about it being exposed to the other traditions, is that there's something very simple about it. It's like you are Buddha, you are awakened. You have the wisdom and compassion within you. All you need to do is sit and connect to it. And everybody does that same practice. I mean, over the years, of course, your understanding of it and the different supports maybe that you've been given and teachings you've been given transform you, but you all just sit in the same room together. It's a really beautiful practice to me in that way.
Yeah, so let's go with that. So the simplicity of sitting, what has that done for you? And maybe just explain what that means. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this who really have no idea anything about Buddhist sitting and anything to do with Zen. So just walk us through that in a way for an outsider looking in. What is it like to sit, and why is that really at the core?
Such a rich question. So sitting meditation, it's an opportunity to connect with oneself. And I think a lot of us, and it seems so simple and it seems like, oh, that should be easy or that's kind of boring or whatever you might have assumptions about what it is. But it's actually quite hard to do, especially if you've never done it before, to just sit and be present. And that's the core of it. It's the Zen tradition and Buddhist religion is really a practice of being with what is, being in our bodies, being aware of like this great resource we have of embodiment. And it's through, for most people, I think it's through that like getting still and being present with ourselves that the sense of interconnection with the world and all beings can open up. And part of that too is starting to see like all these things that we tell ourselves. And all of these like memories and feelings that arise, that kind of color experience. And so we can be relating to somebody, not like in the present moment as they are, but like through all these filters of past experience and past hurts. So sitting really gives us an opportunity to get present to what we carry, and come back to something that's more essential than all the thoughts and the stories that we put on top of reality.
How have you been able to just enter into the desire to sit? Like, I mean, like, was it just because you want to do what other people were doing, and just try, you just had strong mentors or models, or like, what really gave you the impulse? Like, this is really something I think I need to do.
My first experience with meditation actually was during a mass when I was in high school after I had read a Thich Nhat Hanh book. And I was like, oh, I'm just gonna be with my breath and be present in my body, which felt groundbreaking to high school me, who was used to like daydreaming and hearing things and like processing and thinking about stuff. And it was like, oh, I could just like, with my breath as my guide, like just be present in my body and experience life. And let's try that out. And so I did, and I had quite a profound experience when it came to the time of receiving the Eucharist. And that gave me just so much faith in the practice of meditation that I started to seek it out more. And I think that often happens for people who come to meditation. They've had maybe some kind of peak experience of being really present. And that's part of the motivation for like, oh, I want to like be this more in my life because it seems so vital.
Does it change the way that you go about your day? Obviously, those moments can be so profound, like you say. But then, what happens when when the sit ends and you have to do what you have to do? I'd like to believe that the being, it helps you be who you are, even while you have to do what you do.
I love the way you
But
said that.
I guess my question is, what is different about your life these days now that you have, now that this is part of your practice?
Yeah, I really immersed myself in it. So I feel like I'm probably a totally different person than I would be if I had never discovered this practice. And just that, like, I'm in touch with the silence and stillness of being pretty much all the time and can tune into it at any moment. Which, in a way, how that changes is I'm less reactive, like, how that's changed. I'm less reactive. I'm more confident, more just trusting of the universe, of life itself, more connected to others. So, that's me. And I'm somebody who immersed myself in 12 years of monastic training. And I'm now a Zen teacher, a meditation teacher. I find, like, with people who are just starting a meditation practice, that there is that aspect, exactly how you named it, of you don't even have to do anything. Like to sit for 20 minutes a day or even 10 minutes a day, it puts you in touch with that being aspect that ripples out into your life in ways that you find yourself pausing and being quiet or not reacting right away. And that can definitely be fuel to continue to do it because it is hard and people often feel like my life is so busy and to just sit and do nothing, like it kind of gets off the to-do list pretty quickly for a lot of people. But those moments of, oh yeah, it does carry forward and I'm kinder and I'm less reactive. Often people have some kind of experience of that. And then another thing I'd say is you can carry the practice forward intentionally because it's about being present, and that's what mindfulness really is. It's taking opportunities throughout your day or just being grounded in present moment experience more and more.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the particulars of sitting. So, like, did you kind of experiment with actual ways to physically sit? Like, what is a proper posture to be able to sit, to be able to be the most receptive? So that's maybe my first question. And the second question, which I think is what a lot of people tend to kind of inquire about when it comes to meditation, is like, how what did you do with the monkey mind at the beginning? Just the endless thoughts and things like that. So maybe some of the practicals.
In a way, there's no wrong posture. The Buddha taught meditation, sitting, walking, standing, and lying down, and those are most of the postures that we're in. The Zen tradition tends to emphasize upright sitting, and I found that to be particularly helpful. Like lying down for me, I fall asleep or I quickly start to daydream. If that's the only option that your body has, you definitely can meditate lying down. But yeah, the Zen tradition tends to emphasize sitting upright. And I'm somebody, I started meditating when I was before I was 20. So I like had flexibility. Like I was a gymnast early in life. I was athletic. So it wasn't hard for me to sit in like the cross-legged postures that I was that were demonstrated to me when I was first learning to practice and went to a Zen center. But there people sit in chairs. And the main emphasis is that to have the body upright can definitely support longer periods of meditation. If you're just meditating for 20 minutes, you know, leaning back on a couch or in a chair or just sitting in the way that you regularly sit, you probably won't start to feel fatigue in your body. But if you're trying to meditate for longer periods of time, it definitely can be helpful to sit with an upright spine and to have your hips above your knees, whether you're sitting in a chair or on the ground, because it supports your body in using its natural musculature, which just allows us to be both alert and relaxed. And that in and of itself is its own process. I remember the first year or so that I started sitting, and I went to a monastery, and I had just this like pain in my shoulder, and it felt like somebody was stabbing me in the back with a knife. I would use that analogy. And this woman was like, "You, that might be your experience for the next 10 years." Like, because I kept trying to like do something. And something about her saying that, like, let me just relax and feel it. And it actually like resolved itself within the time I was at the monastery, which was just a month. So that was an interesting experience just with the body, because I think physically it can be painful to sit still, or like the places that we carry tension and pain can seem amplified. And then in response to how to practice with the mind, it's often helpful to have some anchor in the present moment. In the meditation traditions, they talk about meditation with support and meditation without support, where you're just resting in presence, which is really hard to do without any kind of meditation teaching. Just like, okay, just sit and be present. You know, it sounds like, oh, that should be something I can do. Like, I'm human, but it's hard to do. So
Blank
having.
canvases are far harder, right, than a start. Yeah.
So having some kind of practice, my practice when I first started was the breath. So I would just keep coming back to the breath.
And what was that actual breath anchor look like? Like when how did you focus on your breath? Was there a certain way of like, I mean, was it like a box breath? Is that something that you kind of experiment with? I mean, I don't know if people even may understand what that means, but like, is there a way of like counting how you were breathing or extending your exhale more intentionally?
There are so many ways that breath meditation is taught. The first way that I learned was counting. And probably at that point, it's kind of hard for me to remember exactly, but probably at that point, I didn't even feel the breath as much, probably not as much as I feel it now, but I know now from working with students that a lot of times, like starting with counting the breath is really like the meditation is like somewhat with the breath, but also maybe mostly with the counting. And the way I was taught is like on the inhalation, you just breathe naturally. And then on the exhalation, you say in your head, and then you just let the inhale naturally. So it usually means if you're doing that you are emphasizing the exhalation and maybe extending it more than you normally would if you were just letting your breath breathe naturally. So it gives you a lot to focus on. And then the instruction often is you count to 10 and then you start back at one. And I feel like I don't think I ever got to 10 when I was doing
Right.
that. Or I would get
Right.
to like 41. I'm like, oh, how did I get here?
No. Maybe, how about you talk a little bit about the difference with sitting alone and sitting with others, and maybe a little bit more of your monastic experience, because you spend a substantial amount of your really adult life in a monastery and did lots of leadership roles within it as well. And so maybe talk a little bit about what was advantageous about sitting with others in a monastic context.
I feel like, people are so different. And for me, being in community was necessary to really stay with my direct experience and to deepen in meditation. And I don't think I would have been able to do it if I were alone. For various reasons, like distraction being probably the highest reason, but also just responsibilities and just things that we can get kind of caught up in daily life. And I find, I live in the city now, I live on my own. It is because I have all of that experience, it's not hard for me to have a morning practice and an evening practice, and I usually do that alone. But we also have so Mud Lotus Sangha is the sangha here in Columbus, and we rent a room, and people can come. Like a lot of sitting groups or sanghas exist this way that people could come and just join. And a lot of people say like they feel more focused. The group, like the group energy, there's a group field. It's pretty amazing. We're just sitting in silence together. But there's that commitment of like, I know that these other people are going to stay with whatever's arising for them, and their support, and I'm supporting them in doing that, and they're supporting me in doing that. And sometimes, especially I've found during like longer retreats, it can be hard. Of course. I mean, it can be hard when you're just starting meditation too, to like f keep finding the motivation for yourself to stay with, especially difficult experiences that come up. And meditation, especially like long meditation retreats, they tend to have a kind of purificatory experience for a lot of people, where difficult emotions that maybe you got buried in the course of living a human life, or you haven't just been able to dedicate time to feeling like as you're practicing the sitting meditation. My teacher would use the analogy, it's like an acupuncture needle, zazen, or meditation is like an acupuncture needle, and it allows these unhealed parts of us to come up and be included and be felt and integrated. And it's really hard to do that if you are just totally by yourself. And so I know from my experience and working with others, like being able to lean into like the community support is just so powerful in those moments in particular, to feel not alone in it.
And people can go run 26 miles anytime they want, but somehow
We like to wait for the marathon to come around, right? When an
Right,
organized thing.
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that applies to so many things that we do that are kind of crazy.
Yeah. Is that healing aspect that you mentioned, is that a part of what Zen means by awakening? When as we could you talk about that?
I think in the largest sense of awakening, for sure. For sure. Because in the largest sense of awakening, we're talking about becoming truly who we are. And that includes like our whole humanness and also having a touchstone in the vast field of interconnection, as we call it in Buddhism. And so the healing part is like that coming into our full humanness, and that can involve like the healing pieces of really integrating parts of ourselves that maybe we've disowned, or coming closer to memories of pain and loss and being able to feel them fully, but also like really awakening to our gifts and our talents and our vow for this life. We use that word a lot in the Buddhist tradition, which is similar to like vocation, like the heart's aspiration to, be of service, be in connection with others, and to show up in our fullness there.
Given that you grew up Catholic, I wondered if there are some things that Catholics or Christians tend to misunderstand about Zen or about Buddhism that you could help us to better understand.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's so interesting to me that Zen in particular, there are a lot of people who have a Catholic background. I just want to say that's not quite answering your question, but you just made me think of that. I've met so many people who grew up Catholic. I think like there's a ritual aspect of Zen that feels familiar. I think maybe one of the biggest understandings about Buddhism in general is that like the Buddha isn't considered a god, and we don't worship the Buddha. The Buddha is seen as like a great teacher, a wise one who opened up the path of practice. And so like the early Buddhist teachings are often like the teachings of the Buddha, but in the biggest sense of the word Buddha, we're talking about each being fully who they are, and that's a Buddha, that's an awakened one. And I think that can get misunderstood, like there's some kind of like worshiping or deification of this one person, and so that can feel like a conflict perhaps with Catholic belief.
Do you find them in conflict? I mean, is it something? If you care to share, I'm curious, like, what your continued story kind of looked like as you got more into, we heard about the profound moment. But I'm curious what happened next.
I think when I was in high school, I was really trying to like reconcile and integrate like this upbringing that I had in Catholicism with this kind of meditative tradition that I was opening to and getting a lot out of. And I didn't know how to do that on my own, and I didn't have like an elder I could look to who was like, oh, this is how they fit together. And when I first moved to the monastery, my teacher kind of tried, and she gave me some books by Buddha, or by Catholic priests who had also have had a Buddhist practice, like Robert Kennedy, I think is that his name? Father Kennedy?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
I think he's a Jesuit, maybe.
And at the time, like I wasn't ready for that, and I wanted to immerse fully in the Buddhist practice, and it was just kind of helpful for me to like, in a way, like put the Catholic language aside, knowing that it's like in me because of my upbringing, and just immerse myself in a tradition that I was, in a way, getting to receive and was being transmitted to me. And it's been more, actually, more recently, since I left the monastery, that I'm reconnecting with the Bible. I'm reading Father John R. Gribbs' Substack regularly, and I like practice Lent in a way that I haven't before. And like, I love the ritual of Catholicism, and I love the stories of the Bible and of Jesus. And I, you know, when I was growing up, I never really read the Bible. Like, it was read to us in ways at church, but I didn't have so much a personal connection to it. And I think at this stage in my life, I'm actually more able to read it and receive the message, and now, like, see how much in common there is with the Dharma practice.
Yeah, I mean that was really a lot of the impetus behind this podcast, and maybe even more specific, this season of it, where we really do believe, I'm speaking for Dave and I guess in this case, from what we've been picking up and just people we've interviewed and who have all different vantage points within the church, there's this greater need for listening, just in general. Like, it's a very noisy world. There's lots of places you can go to get content and information. But really, what is the drive behind all this going on? What are people really searching for? Why, what is the desire for certainty, which seems to be a very big, profound thing as to why people latch onto certain types of ideologies, for example. So, like, given that that seems to be what is very evident in the world, what is underlies that? Is what we're trying to listen to. And I think as we do that, it goes beyond us trying to kind of neatly put it into, say, religious or spiritual categories, that it's getting to a deeper heart of what it is that Jesus actually reveals to us, which is this sense of incarnation or sacramentality, which is another way of saying that everything, there's nothing that escapes the very presence of God. So everything can become a portal of entry into seeing this incredible interconnectivity if we are allowing ourselves to do that. And you look at, say, the Catholic or Christian mystical tradition, and you look at, say, even the early type of mystical tradition, which emerges like in the Gospel of John. Here you have a gospel writer who begins his gospel talking about the Word existing for all time and space, and then becoming flesh, which now he's referring about Jesus. But this whole sense of the word, the logos, is clearly, I think, something that could be very in concert with Zen teaching of realizing that, there's something that is within and outside of us that brings order and structure to things. There's a certain type of logos, a certain type of logic to things. And how open are we to kind of seeing how the dots connect, so to speak? Or how open are we to seeing how even the things that we think are so outside the scope of anything good or anything divine or holy actually can do something to reveal something within us that maybe we would not have understood in any other way? So I like to think that there's absolutely nothing within, say, the Christian message as embodied in Jesus, that would work against a sense of looking at oneself in relationship to the whole, which is exactly, to me, the essence of incarnation. Like, how is it that we show up in the world because this is how ultimately the divine has showed up within us, if that makes sense. I don't know if that sits with you or if you kind of think of it in those terms, or if there's something that you could add to that, or
Yeah, I definitely, those terms feel fresh. But that, the spirit of it feels very familiar. of yeah, sometimes we say in Zen terms, like Dharma gates are numberless. Like every being, everything we encounter is a reflection of the one, including us, including everything that we contain. And yeah, that's part of what struck me in what you were just sharing. That it's like all one life, and it's spirit, and it's incarnate, it's material, it's each being.
How about you unpack a little bit for us who may not be familiar with Buddhism an understanding of suffering? Because that seems to be at the very crux of so much of Buddhist teaching. Sometimes it's controversial to say the way that it's articulated. And we can touch upon all of them: suffering, desire, and compassion. I mean, like, what are those words mean to you as someone who's kind of really drank in so much of the Buddhist tradition?
The one of the quotes from the Buddha about suffering is he said, I teach suffering and the way and freedom from suffering. So it is such an anchor in the Buddhist teachings to explore. And then the question is, like, what is suffering? What are we talking about? And it's rich, because I think we have, like, well, we're talking about this, like, whatever our experience is, our association with suffering, and that's included for sure. But the meaning of the word suffering in Buddhism, it's dukkha is the Sanskrit word, and it's a like a wheel that's like has friction. It's not like turning on its axis in a way that, like, in the way it could. It's getting caught. And so the investigation is like, oh, what, we know what that feels like, that sense of like something is not right. And then what do we do next when that feeling arises? And usually what we do is we like try to get rid of it or ignore it, or we get distracted and try to get some other better experience, so like we at least kind of can numb out from that feeling. And the Buddha was interested in, and this is like kind of the whole of the Dharma teachings, is like, well, what if you didn't do those things? What if you investigated it? What is this experience of intolerability or friction or something is not right? And so, what the Buddha said is like it involves some form of clinging, like some form of identification. And this is a large part of what sitting practice is, and just the ongoing practice of Dharma is to start to like unwind that fixation with trying to get things to be the way we think they should be. And you asked about compassion. The primary piece of that is like, that's an act of compassion to be with, the places in us that feel the most unbearable. And in that, like, to find that love touches those places too.
That's beautiful.
One thing that you mentioned right before the end there was this idea of control that we seem to need to exert over our lives and others. And I think that's another area of resonance between the two traditions, that humility calls us to give up control and surrender to what is, as you might say. And I guess I just one of the things. So I wanted to ask about, you seem to be living an engaged Buddhism, as Thich Nhat Hanh might call it, right? And one of the things that John and I have talked about is how the Eucharist, Eucharist has become so revered in Catholic theology and in the minds of Catholics, at least mass attending Catholics, let's say, that we call it the source and summit, using that familiar language. It becomes like the end, but the point of the mass, the name of the mass is to be sent. It's actually supposed to be the beginning. You're consuming Christ in order to be Christ in the world as you go about your day, which reminds me a lot about what you're saying about, you know, the purpose of sitting, so that you can carry that with you, you know, be who you really are as much as possible, even when you're not, you know, sitting in silence. And my question, without trying to get into like the control aspect, so I don't know exactly how to ask this, but you know, how do you strike the right balance? How do you know when that's enough sitting? I'm ready to be in the world. You know, like, how do we, what is the right, you know, because for, if a Catholic is, there's nothing, I would never tell someone, you know, you shouldn't be doing Eucharistic adoration. But I would say that you shouldn't be doing only Eucharistic adoration, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you think about that?
In a large way, I feel like it has to do with people's personal like proclivities or vows, and to notice when am I kind of using sitting because I developed this kind of comfortable, you know, at some point for a lot of people, meditation can start to feel like comfortable and like, and even maybe take on a quality of a kind of withdrawal or hiding out. And so like, whenever the world starts to feel too stressful, I go and like find my
escapism.
And that's, you know, kind of an extreme example, but I know that that happens for a lot of people with the sitting practice. So to notice that, like, oh, how am I connected to the spirit of compassion? And in Buddhism, we call it the bodhisattva heart, the bodhisattva vow, and our own vow in that, because, you know, I lived in a monastery for 12 years. We did a week of meditation retreat, intensive meditation retreat every month. So, you know, I've done a lot of meditation that in a way doesn't have like a function besides like being, because I'm doing it with others, like, you know, it has that quality of offering, like, and at some point in my practice, I started to see it that way. Like this is offering. This isn't about me and attaining some particular state of mind that I'm going to try to hold on to, which is its own form of suffering. But like, this is offering. This is my body and life offered to all beings. And so in that, in connection to that vow, I think we have a sense of, oh, when am I just kind of using meditation as like an escape? And when is it in service of this larger vow that I'm living into?
That's a really great way to talk about monasticism in general. You know, I think there are a lot of critics of monks who just say, well, this is, you're just leaving the world. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, no, this is actually for the world, which I think is right.
Yeah. And in the monastery where I lived, you felt that viscerally. We had people coming and going constantly, like coming for a week of residency just to check it out. Coming, we would have like 20 to 50 people coming to join us for the retreat. And so there was a sense of like, oh, this is an offering to anyone who comes, and then knowing like they're taking it back out into their lives and a new group of people are going to come and create practice together. So it wasn't like a secluded kind of practice. Mm-hmm. And even so, I think what you just said is true, like that it can still be an offering, even if, you know, people aren't coming to join. But we felt that very viscerally in our particular monastic place.
How did you discern out of the monastery? I'm curious.
So In our tradition, at some point, as you're practicing with your teacher, it's a very lineage based tradition, and it has this quality of apprenticeship. So I was living and practicing with my teachers for the whole time that I lived at the monastery, and they gave me Dharma transmissions. So that means now that I can have like trained students and trained teachers eventually. And at that point, it felt like I entered a discernment process at that point of like, am I going to stay here and continue to live with my teachers, or is something like, is there something next? And it after like a year of discernment, it felt like I need to at least step out for some time.
So one path would have been to stay and become a teacher yourself.
Yeah, and I am a teacher myself. Yeah, but it would have been to stay and just continue to train monastics at the monastery, or to help be part of that training.
Was it jarring re-entering the non-monastic world?
In some ways, I felt ready, like very ready. And that maybe is part of just speaking to living my vow. It's been challenging, but I really feel in touch. And it's also been like so many gifts, so many, and I think this happens in everybody's life, but it's just been beautiful. Like we showed up in Columbus. I was like, I don't know, like, are we going to have a Sangha in Columbus? And, somebody eventually like invited us to teach. They happened to like be running a space that's just 5 blocks from our house. I went to another Dharma group's practice, and the person sitting next to me recognized me from the monastery. So there have been these little like, you're on the right track, like we're supporting you moments that have felt really precious.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us just a little bit about what your day-to-day looks like right now regarding your personal practice, and then also what you're able to offer.
Yeah.
And you can even bring in a little bit about Earth Dreams, you know, your Substack too, if that's helpful.
Yeah. So I wake up in the morning and I sit like first thing. Usually I make a little bit of tea before I sit. And I'm doing a practice right now that involves also chanting, which is part of the Buddhist tradition, having a kind of liturgy, and that helps me connect with Bodhisattva vow, and also just helps me connect with, like, let my practice be part of the world. And then I work one-on-one with people. So today there's a Sangha member that I've been meeting with who's in the dying process, and I meet with her on Zoom, and I met with her and her husband. It's one of the first people I saw. And then I have people that I do more like spiritual counseling with, which is a blend of spiritual direction and like more working with things that are coming up for them in their lives in a more like mindfulness oriented way, somatic oriented way. I'm trained in both internal family systems and a psychotherapy called Hakomi that are supportive and just really using mindfulness to contact like difficult states that people are having trouble being with on their own, and moving through grief or making sense of things that have happened in their life. So I usually have like 4 or 5 clients that I'm seeing in that way. And then I also meet with students in Oregon or in Ohio for like a 20-minute practice check-in. And that is part of my day too. So I met with 2 people in Oregon today on Zoom and talked about their practice. And like often that involves more, I mean, it includes their meditation practice, but it also involves more like, how am I living my practice in my life? And
I mean, that's a pretty intense schedule in so many different ways. I mean, like your practice seems to be, would be essential to show up for all those different people. I mean, how are you able to ground yourself when you go from person to person with their own experience? I mean, I speak as this as a priest, I mean, you're kind of bombarded in this way when you're hearing confessions, and those are only lasting however many minutes, but you have to constantly go from person to person. It's not necessarily a seamless type of transition, or at least it doesn't feel that way, but in a lot of ways it is too. Is there a grounding practice that you find to be helpful? And I think this is helpful for anyone listening too, when they are just kind of dealing with a difficult situation, either within themselves or with a person they're meeting, how to kind of just allow yourself to receive more than to feel the need to give, because it's only through the receiving that you even know what to give.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I think a big thing that I'm learning is that, and I think I learned this for myself through Zazen, and now I'm learning it through working with others, that it's not about fixing or making it better. And yet somehow in the like listening and being with, healing happens, and it almost happens every single time, at least some form of healing. And, you know, a lot of that is, and I don't think I, you know, quite realized this like before I became a teacher, even though I probably experienced on the student side, of like just being witnessed and being with another human being in our darkest moments or in our pain is healing, is profound. And I have faith in that, and I'm like growing faith in that like part of my job right now is just to be here with you and not, and let you know that I'm not afraid of whatever you're experiencing, even though parts of me might be, of course, I'm human. I can touch into what isn't afraid, or what can hold the fear and still be here in love. And that's something I come back to a lot, is just this felt sense of love in the heart space that's bigger than me, like the love unconditioned. And yeah, that's
of course very Christian, right?
Yeah.
That's what we just we're recording this during Easter time right now. I mean, that's what we just kind of celebrate it with, like, you know, what's it like to just sit with suffering, realizing that there's some hope even in the midst of that somehow, you know. I want to talk about something maybe that ends up being controversial in some certain circles when speaking of Buddhism, and just kind of looking at like the Four Noble Truths, and maybe you could do a better job at articulating it too, is just the whole issue of desire. Like, you know, we suffer because we desire something that is not. And so we're just kind of in this place of like, I wish it was different than what it is. So if you're sick, the reason why you're suffering is because you want to be healthy. And so that desire to be healthy is really what was the issue, more than the fact that you're sick. And if you were able to kind of rid yourself of the desire to be healthy, you'd be able to not even be in the state of suffering, because you would be able to accept what is. Now, some people read that and will say, well, like, what would motivate anyone to do anything that would kind of eradicate, let's say, the world of things that are unjust? Like, what motivates a person to kind of work towards social justice, or to be able to kind of right wrongs that clearly seem to be wrong, if the whole point is like, just don't be upset that things aren't right, because that's what's causing your own internal pain and struggle. I said it that way just because that seems to be what the criticism is. I mean, I personally have a way of understanding that differently, but I just wanted to kind of throw that out there, because what would you say to an interpretation in that way?
Yeah. First, I think we misunderstand desire in what the Buddha meant by desire in the Four Noble Truths. I definitely think there is an element of, you know, noticing how we can create more suffering on top. And there's this teaching that's become really popular just kind of throughout therapeutic culture of the two arrows, which is a teaching by the Buddha. And he said the first arrow is the experience itself, which we can't control. It's happening. There's pain. There's difficulty, there's grief, there's loss. That's what's happening right now. But the second arrow is, you know, what we're telling ourselves about that, like, oh, this shouldn't be happening. And so a part of practice in Dharma is, you know, to notice, when am I putting that second arrow in? So it's less about, like, you should rid yourself of desires, and more about, well, notice when the desire arises for it to be different, and how does that add to suffering in this moment? Because it doesn't mean that, and this is where I think compassion really comes in. It's like the compassionate response is to alleviate suffering, you know, to alleviate suffering, to like do whatever we can do to alleviate suffering. That's in Buddhism, we have this archetype of the Bodhisattva of compassion, who has thousands of hands and eyes, and sees the suffering in the world. And then also within each hand is a tool. And so it's like all the different responses to suffering. So it's like if you're sick, like, can you accept the experience right now? And like, that doesn't mean that you don't do whatever you possibly can to get better. And I think it can be this interesting place. And in Buddhism, we emphasize not knowing. And there's something that you said earlier about, like, that, just like that kind of like needing to be certain and have some kind of, and in that not knowing, I think that's where pure possibility is. And it's like, okay, what if we don't know what's going to happen with this illness, or with, you know, whatever the situation is? What if we can enter not knowing and being with what is happening as it's happening, and then let the compassionate response arise? Because it will. And it won't come from the mind that wants to control. It's coming from a bigger source of wisdom. And, you know, that's hard to do. But like, I think as we get in the habit of like, oh, can I be with this suffering and allow and trust that compassion will come?
Yeah, and when we talk about compassion, we're also talking about self-compassion, which is like, I think, even more foundational because of the fact that like we're pretty hard on ourselves. And I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about also just the art of discernment, which is, you know, clearly found in so many different traditions, very much so in the Christian tradition. We mentioned a Jesuit earlier, Robert Kennedy, but there's other. I mean, that's part of an Ignatian practice. It's like, what is it that I'm supposed to do because of what is? Not thinking that there's always one note on the piano that's always right in every song. You know, how attentive am I to the music in front of me, so I know exactly what to play, how to respond, and that comes from the place of both self-compassion and compassion towards others. Like that seems to me to be the way that the song is to be played in harmony with the cosmos at that point. You know, if we want to take it really.
You're talking about improvisation in jazz, basically, that life is more like jazz than it is like composed music. But even jazz, you know, jazz musicians are more prepared, or have more, you know, preparation in terms of knowing their stuff than anybody, right? And so that goes back to the practices that we're building day in, day out to help us to be ready for what comes.
Beautiful.
I guess I'll just end this the way you have in the past, John. You know, you mentioned to Amy that the big thing we heard from season one from our guests is how sacred listening is. And so I just wonder if there's any advice that you could give to our listeners about how to listen, or how you listen and cultivate that practice of listening.
I think that's so important. Practically, I think it can be really beautiful. And this is a meditation practice, but it's something you can do anytime, anywhere, is just to listen and to notice what you're hearing and to hear what you're hearing. And this gets back to the music as like a piece of music unfolding. And see if your listening can include listening to your inner experience as well. I think we can be so like externally focused and so focused on like words and our thoughts and the content of our thoughts and the content of other people's words that it can be such a beautiful practice to like release that, like needing to control or know in a moment and just to receive and receive sound and receive tempo and receive rhythm and receive the energy underneath the words and receive our thoughts as just part of the landscape of listening, and also to be in that silence that's before and includes all sound.
Thank you so much for being here and being with us.
Thank you.
Amy Kise, wow. I almost didn't want to put Kyra Jewel and Amy back to back because their calm, settled voices, it just doesn't get any more, any calmer and deeper than this throughout the entire season. So don't get too used to this this super relaxed and yet super insightful type of thing. Not that there won't be more insights. We have lots of great more Buddhism insights for you coming up. In fact, our next episode is with Michael McCord, who is a Zen priest. And so we'll start to hear from, a preacher and clergy of Buddhism. Definitely don't want to miss it. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. We're so glad you're here, but I'd also love to have you join our free online monthly gathering. It's an interfaith monthly gathering that we do. And you can find out more about where to register for that and lots of other things about the podcast on our Substack, religiontoreality.substack.com. Father John is also on Substack. His is called Going Analog and can be found at johngribowitch.substack.com. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. And you can listen to this wherever you are listening to this. But if you happen to be listening to this on the web or something like that, it might be easier for you to use a platform like Apple Podcasts or Spotify or what have you, where you can actually follow the show and get notified whenever new episodes come out. Thanks for listening.